I always knew there were other people whose nuisance value would be greater than their usefulness. During which conversation he told me I'd done my last show. We never think that we're some kind of guerrilla contingent inside a broadcasting organisation.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Mark Goodyear.
I grew up in a family of extremely nice, I think bright, caring people, but very square mum and dad. By that I mean they knew nothing about popular culture, didn't really care for it, but they did love music. They absolutely loved, and still to this day, love classical music. I think it'd be tough to find two more diehard fans of Radio 3.
Good morning, everyone. It's Patricia Hughes in London.
I also loved classical music, and I loved playing cello and piano and double bass as a kid, and up until the age of about 11, they had hopes that I'd probably be a musician and an academic or at least have a university degree. And I lived in North Wales for a while and had a very simple life growing up in a village not far from Bangor. And then my dad, who was a Nature Conservancy regional officer, meaning it was his job to, you know, have a view on protection of the countryside, he had that job for the first 8 years of my life, and then he got the same job in Scotland. So we moved to Edinburgh at the age of eight, where I sort of had my teenage and formative years. And something happened when I was 11. I was at secondary school, and the kids in the playground were discussing the previous night's Top of the Pops. I was living in this sort of classical family. We didn't have a telly. I was in this bubble where there was literally no popular culture in my life, and the kids were talking about last night's Top of the Pops. And I just stood on the periphery of the conversation, as I sort of have tended to do in life. What they were talking about sounded interesting.
A couple of weeks ago, when everyone was getting involved in prognostications for 1973, focus were tipped to do very great things. It looks as though this year could be big.
And then I was asked for an opinion on what I thought of it. So I faked it and said I thought it was great. And I felt so bad about faking it, I went straight home and turned the Sony Cube transistor AM radio from Radio 3 to 247 Radio 1, and I was just captivated by it.
Radio 1 on 247 meters and VHF with sounds of the 70s.
Radio 1!
People communicating, a wide range of people actually, from those who we now think of as hugely great legacy performers like Tony Blackburn, but who were entertainers who loved music, but really Tony was an entertainer as opposed to Johnny Walker, who was just a passionate guy searching for music. I mean, the whole reason for his being was that. And everything in between, even from Peel, who, when I was a Peel listener, was playing both sides of Eric Clapton 461 Ocean Boulevard and Rod Stewart Killing of Georgie Parts 1 and 2 uninterrupted.
A fine start, I think you'll agree, to practically any programme. On this week's programme, we have Ralph Mattel.
What came over to me was music I never heard that I really quickly grew to love. And people conveying their love for that. And, you know, a whole range of characters, from Stuart Henry, who I really loved the sound of, and Roscoe, whose energy I loved. It was a way to hear a world that I had absolutely no experience of.
I'll tell it like it is. Lovely young lady, Freda Faye. And how about that number one almost around the world now?
The Roscoe Show.
You got it!
R-O-S-K-O, Roscoe.
We play much more music in 1.5 hours than any other place.
But I kind of knew immediately I wanted to do it. It's really odd, because I definitely was not on that track. And my parents are very kind of light-touch parents, which has made me a light-touch parent, which hasn't always gone well. And I don't think they knew what to do. It was hoped I'd get a proper job, and I think they did say that. And I think even though I'd done 8.5 years in commercial radio before I got to Radio 1, I think they almost hoped I'd go back and get to uni and pick up the subjects I sort of half-heartedly started. So I think radio took me to somewhere where I've been that otherwise I would have never got to. It would have just been just as good to have gone to university and done a proper job. It would have been just as good, but it would have been very different. I don't know what makes other people do what they do and why they do it. If I decide I want to do something, although it took me many years to get this, I just literally go headlong for it. And sometimes that's great. Occasionally it's really not that great. But even if you're not quite right in a thought, if you really believe it, you know, I think you have a really good chance of making it happen. We didn't have a telly, so I used to go blag my way around to my friend Johnny's house down the road where they had a colour telly. When we eventually got a telly, it was black and white, of course. And, you know, so I got to see Top of the Pops if I was lucky enough to get invited or blag my way to a friend's house. And I kind of just decided I was going to do it. I decided that I was going to be on the radio, and I used to walk to school telling my good friend who lived around the corner that as I was carrying the transistor radio, listening to the Radio 1 Breakfast Show with Noel or Dave Lee Travis, that I was going to do that job. And of course, I was mocked senselessly for thinking that. But I kind of thought, I really want to do it. I'm only thinking about that.
Good morning.
Right now, we're going to continue with the good sounds. And while I readjust myself to this time in the morning, I need a little help. And a little help from Radio 1.
And I just started doing all the things that you do. Like, my parents were not unsupportive. In fact, considering how alien this was to them, my dad would do things like he would build, and he's not a handyman, but he would build me a wooden console to put my SP25 Mark IV decks and my foul disco mixer into so I could start my mobile disco. So they kind of helped me in the way that they thought they could along the way, whilst at the same time knowing that I hardly attended school because I just wanted to listen to the radio. And I became expert in forging my mum's handwriting so that I could write my own notes for not being able to attend school. I must have had an appalling sickness record in secondary school. Well, I set up this mobile disco called Mr. Sound Chaser. This is a sign of kind of ambition as well, so it wasn't enough for me to have one mobile disco. So if I got a booking and then I got another booking, and on some occasions I got a third booking, we would split the rig and cobble together and beg, steal and borrow lights or speakers to enable us to put three rigs out. And I have my two brothers, or at least one of my brothers, doing one of the gigs and a friend doing a third. We'd split the records. Everything was just absolutely insane. So I knew no limit to my capacity to not say no. So we did mobile discos for pretty much all of my teenage years, whilst also blagging my way into Forth and Clyde, and used to persuade parents of friends who had some kind of contact in the West to take us through. And people were very gracious. Brian Ford at Forth, I must have been 13 or 14, would allow me to sit in on shows. And Paul Coyer at Clyde would allow me to sit in on shows. I used to find ways of getting on the train to Glasgow to sit in on the late show or sit in on Brian's late show on Forth. I kind of just had to be there. It was good enough for me just to be there, to talk to them and to soak up the vibe. And that just affirmed that this is what I was going to do. And I very nearly got a gig on Forth when I was 16. But I was very honest. I still always try to be very honest when people ask me a question. But I was asked the question, how old are you, by Tom Steele, who's a legendary Scottish newsman. They always had news guys in charge of radio stations as well. That was interesting, wasn't it? I think actually Richard Park might be the only, or one of the very few music guys who eventually got to control the output of radio stations. He's collected a few now, hasn't he? And Tom said, I can't put you on the air at 16. And I was absolutely crestfallen. I thought that was it. But I persevered and supported the Radio 4 DJs when they did their DJ gigs, and eventually got on the air when I was 18. I'm pretty sure there were absolutely hours every day listening to the radio, trying to work out what to do. It was February 1980. And although I really wanted to do radio, and I kind of soaked up like a sponge as much music as I could, and I was discriminating, so I didn't like everything, but I was kind of open to everything as well. So I did like punk, but I also liked disco. I mean, there weren't very many people who were fans of Chic and and loved Buzzcocks or The Clash or The Pistols. But the first show was a Midnight Till Two show. I remember being down the pub, you know, obviously just having a Coke or something in the evening before the first show. I'm almost unable to speak, you know, for somebody who's going to make a radio debut, it's so nervous I could barely speak. I remember playing Crusaders' Street Life as the first record, never forgotten it, and just being relieved, really, to have done a show and not be fired and not, you know, and for the people who risked putting me on not to think that was the worst, most disastrous start. I play the street life. And I ended up getting three shows a week at Forth, and this was the same many years later at Radio 1. I really couldn't sleep for days leading up to it, and I always was in the radio station all the time. So even when I got to Clyde many years later and had just one show a week, I'd be in the station about 60 hours a week, because I think part of learning this in those days was being around it and seeing how people behave, just learning. You don't stop learning even now after decades later. I mean, I was a kid, because all I did was radio and cross-country running, really, when I was at school. I didn't really grow up. So all the things you need to be a good broadcaster, I wasn't really. I was just somebody who was absolutely fixated on it, had something of a voice, but, you know, you kind of grow into your voice, and I don't think I grew into it actually till many years later. But commercial radio was big in those markets, you know, Forth and Clyde, and North Sound particularly, and the big city stations in England. Those are really important to the local communities in a way that it's difficult to say that they really are now with so much networking. So the presenters there were stars in the market. And while some of them wouldn't have made national radio because they were very locally focused, or they didn't have the right voice, or I suppose in those days the right accent, they were really good at identifying with their audience. And I think now I could learn a lot more from those guys. They were just my heroes at that point. And, you know, obviously I didn't love all of them, but there were some whose skills I would identify much easier now, knowing what I know, than I did then. Again, I had a couple of shows to do, really. I was just there all the time, you know, hanging out in the record library. I think people in those days, because you used to get to pick some records for your show, in fact, the playlisting at Forth, as far as I can remember, except on the chart, was that the people who did the show had to put the records they'd already played to the back of the box, so you could only pick from the front half of the box, and they had to sort of like, they're the top 40 plus anything else that was new that they fancied. And you could go out and hang out in the library and pick some records. What a great way to learn. There's no way to do that now in mainstream broadcasting. I hope you can still do it in student radio, and I hope you can still do it in hospital radio, but I have my doubts a bit. I think I got ahead of myself as a 19-year-old. I'd done 6 or 8 months on the air, but it wasn't long. It was months, not years, at Forth, and George McIntosh, another newsman who was controller of the soon-to-start Radio Tay in Dundee, said, would you come and do the breakfast show? I sort of thought, well, I have to do this. And you don't really have anybody to advise you. Well, I didn't in those days have anybody. I think it was, you know, it was kind of in the 70s and early 80s, radio was quite a new thing in commercial. And there was not a lot of it nationally either. So there weren't people who'd done it all their lives who you could turn to say, should I go and take this breakfast show job at Tay? You just thought, well, it's 5 days a week, isn't it? And it's the breakfast show. What could possibly go wrong? Well, pretty much everything went wrong because, as I said earlier, I was a very naive, hadn't lived radio fan, really, who'd just got on the air. I was just not capable of doing it because I wasn't capable of doing anything other than just being a disc jockey. I couldn't relate to the audience. But I'd never have understood it at the time, and George McIntosh, to his credit, took me off after about 6 months and said, you know what I recommend you should do? You should go and volunteer, get off the air, go and spend 2 or 3 years living and learning your life and finding out what actually matters in life, and then you might be a decent broadcaster. I didn't really like it at the time, because you don't when you're 19 years of age. But he was right. He was really right. And, you know, other people who grew up in a different kind of, you know, broader outlook on the world kind of family, you think of somebody like Chris Evans, who's has lots of life experience, and you knew he did even as a young broadcaster at Piccadilly. I just wasn't that, and you can't be who you're not. So it took me a long time to properly get that, and George McIntosh was right, and I was crazy to go after 6 months.
We're doing it for you.
I ended up doing commercial production at Tay. To their credit, they found me a job. I maybe depped some shows occasionally. And with absolutely no experience. I'd be writing scripts, taking briefs from clients, doing voiceovers. I really hope some of those aren't around in the archive, David, those commercials that I voiced there. But it was useful learning. And while I was doing that, about 6 months in, I got a call via reception. And somebody said, there's Richard Park on the phone for you. And the name didn't connect for some reason. And like an idiot, I said, oh, tell him a callback. And so about an hour later, as I was musing, I thought, Richard Park, I know that name. Oh, shit. So Park had phoned from Clyde, and I basically told him to call back when I am less busy. To my luck, a great luck, he did call back, and he said, we'd like to talk with you about a show. He was music controller and Alec Dixon was the boss at Clyde. So I got on the train to Glasgow from Dundee. They liked my voice. Richard had heard me on the chart on Fourth. And the voice has been the instrument that's got me quite a lot of work. Not only voiceover work, but I think I've been lucky enough to have that and to be able to work with it, to make a life with it. And I think that was why Richard Park contacted me. And what his idea was that I did a show called They Sold a Million, which was really playing mostly 50s, late 50s, 60s, and some, but not very many, 70s records for an hour at 5 o'clock on a Sunday. And I said, I don't know anything about these records. And Alec Dixon said, but you will. And they made me research, select, get Richard's approval on every playlist, write the links. And it was one of the most important and powerful lessons I learned. I think my first fees for shows at Fourth was 15 quid a show. Maybe I got 20 quid or something, or 25 quid at Clyde. Then they gave me other shows. I can't remember which ones in which order, but I ended up with a midnight show on a Monday, a Tuesday evening 8 o'clock show, and They Sold a Million, this Sunday afternoon programme, which I then lost because the network chart started with Kid. But They Sold a Million always had more ratings in the Glasgow market than the network chart, because it was local. I think I did sound a lot more Scottish then than I later sounded, but I didn't sound like I was a true Glaswegian. But it was from Clyde, and Clyde was a massive station. I think it was on, you know, mid-50s share, you know, it was... Just don't really get that anymore.
That one's been with us for quite some time. It's Yazoo, up one place to number two, and that's Don't Go. All right, here it comes. Just gone 5-2. The rundown of the...
You had to do everything, but at Clyde there were great journalists. There were people who ended up, like Alan Boyd, who ended up at Radio 2, who's a very good friend of mine, almost a decade older, who had life, you know, much more life experience. And I kind of only started to grow up there and become a slightly better broadcaster. It all seemed to go very well at Radio Clyde. In fact, I did have 5 years there, and I did 1,000 voiceovers and 1,000 gigs, and really loved the west of Scotland. But, you know, at the time when this happened, I had just met Jacqueline, who in 2017 I've been married to for 30 years. And I went on holiday, and when I came back, Alan Boyd, who I shared a flat with at the time, said, I think you might have a problem, Mark. And I thought, well, what could that be? And I went in to prep the Monday show. I discovered that while I was away on my first holiday with my soon-to-be wife, Richard had decided with Alex to change the schedule. And the shows I was doing were... The midnight show on a Monday was kind of like a West of Scotland new music show, which had absolutely no boundaries. So it's kind of like a Peel show, but with some acts like Sonic Youth and kind of other fairly impenetrable stuff. And then a show on the Tuesday, which was Glasgow's version of what I did at the evening session at Radio 1, and then a chart show. And they decided to flatten out the output and do mainstream. I think that was a really early start of commercial radio, not trying to serve all of the very wide range of tastes in its market. So Clyde, when I was there and before, was like Radio 2 is now. It had a folk show, a country show, a classical, it had drama, it had, you know, really difficult new music, West of Scotland focused, accessible new music, West of Scotland focused, and a huge Scottish music show with Jack McLaughlin. And a lot of these radio stations over the years have basically been... As somebody who I really rate, actually, I really hated this conversation at the time. Many years later, I was trying to sell a Boy George Club Versive show, which we syndicated at Wise Buddha, to Kiss, and I had a meeting with Tim Schoonmaker, and I said to him, you should really have this show because Boy George is an absolute icon, but he also really loves this stuff and it is what you do. And Tim Schoonmaker said to me, you BBC guys, you're interested in those fantastic, beautiful, ornate flower borders, and we'll just keep cutting the grass. That's where it's gone, kind of. And that's a shame because, in a way, commercial's given it to the BBC. And whereas the BBC in the 70s and early 80s was basically turn-on-the-tap music radio of its type. I did 5 years at Clyde. I came back from holiday. Richard Park asked me to come for a walk along the canal. It wasn't then, and I'm sure it's not that much different, not the most attractive stroll you could take in the west of Scotland, from Clyde down to Clydebank Shopping Centre. And we ended up sat in a Greggs, and I bought us a cup of tea, during which conversation he told me I'd done my last show, and that was it. And people laughed for years that he'd taken me to sack me and I'd paid for the cup of tea. Therein lies many a story.
24 hours a day, Radio Clyde brings you music, news and the information you need.
I think that's always difficult when you're in that situation. But I don't know why, but I didn't really think that was defeat or that I should change my job. I always think I was a better broadcaster and slightly more grown up, but not much, 5 years, 6 years into radio than I was when I started. And I sent a tape to Giles Squire at Metro, who I think everybody who's worked with knows is one of the best PDs this country's ever had. And he gave me a job 6 weeks later doing overnights and earlies. And in the year I was there, I ended up being on the morning show. And why I think Giles is one of the best radio people this country's ever had is because he identified people who had good things but helped them to understand the things that they could be better at in a way that actually nobody else has done. I've never worked with another PD who would take the time to properly explain to you, without making you feel totally rubbish, what could be better. Very, very rare. I mean, people have attempted it and done it really badly. But if you have somebody who can really coach you and explain to you how you can make a noticeable improvement quite quickly, that's absolutely invaluable. And I think that year at Metro that I had gave me at least a much better chance of getting to Radio 1. I still think I'd never have got to Radio 1 if I hadn't learned some of those lessons. And even then, honestly, I wasn't that good. You know, I was trying hard and I was working much harder at it, but I was still not very grown up and still not understanding everything about relating to the audience. I was still a DJ, basically. I spent a lot of time thinking about it over the years. The people who are really effective, really properly effective, they're not DJs, they're broadcasters. Terry, Johnny Walker, Chris Evans, broadcasters. You know, I still kind of aspire to being properly a broadcaster and not always the top 40 DJ.
Stereo Metro. Favourite music.
After a year of being at Metro, I started sending tapes to Radio 1 when I was at Clyde. I'd heard that, and this was while I was at Metro, I'd heard that Radio 1 were thinking about hiring a Scottish voice, which I really wasn't because I wasn't born there, I wasn't brought up there, but I lived there from the age of eight. So I thought in my kind of super, you know, straight head straight down, go straight forward way, that's me. So I wrote to Johnny Beerling and told him there was nobody better who understood, you know, Scottish music, Scottish radio better than me, and he should hire me. And Johnny, you know, bless him, he, rather than being thinking, what an arrogant dick, he said he would like to meet me. And when I met him, he told me that it was the most arrogant, or one of the most arrogant letters he'd ever received. It didn't really compute with me at all. I just thought it was me making my case. But he gave me 13 weeks. In fact, he gave me a succession of 13-week contracts. And I remember my first Radio 1 show, which was Boxing Day 1987. Again, like the first show on Radio 4, so nervous I couldn't eat my Christmas dinner. I was in Glasgow. My in-laws couldn't eat at all. And the first record was Pet Shop Boys' version of Always On My Mind.
Maybe I didn't treat you quite as good as I should.
I remember thinking, thank God I got away with it. But I was never really sure because, you know, we spoke about getting into fourth, and the same was true of Clyde, massive iconic stations, getting to Radio 1. Everybody else there was to some extent a hero or had an amazing talent or was an amazing broadcaster, not disc jockey. I was really back to being the absolute apprentice. Even though I'd been doing it for 8.5 years, you can't understate what the renewed apprenticeship is when you get to somewhere like that. I think when I got to the BBC, my parents thought, you know, BBC, it'll be okay. Isn't it funny that I did 8.5 years in commercial and, you know, earned a decent living one way or the other? But the BBC, BBC carries a lot, you know, with many generations, and certainly with my parents' generation as lifelong Radio 3 listeners. They listened. They probably didn't like it much. They definitely didn't like the music, but they were very loyal and supportive. Many years later, Giles Squire told me, and this is the thing that I have to accept about myself, everything I've said to you probably makes me sound like a super ambitious person who kind of knew what they wanted, but I genuinely didn't really understand it. I was so kind of focused in that whatever I could do what I wanted to do. And I said to Giles Squire in a conversation, you know, I suppose you have to be quite ambitious, but I always felt I was quite laid back about it. And he said to me, Mark, you're dreaming. You were the most ambitious person. You always talked about getting to Radio 1. And I don't really remember that at the time, but I think it's sort of you. I think you have to have that ambition. And family and friends, I think they were pleased and supportive. You don't get into the job like that. You haven't arrived at the point you get to Radio 1, the point you start at anywhere. You haven't arrived. Your job is only done many years later when you've either built an audience or done something that, you know, records a contribution. Getting there is only the beginning. Inside Radio 1 was a real learning curve, because when you're outside, you have no idea that Radio 1 in the late 80s, and even to this day, is the absolute focus of the record industry. I had absolutely no idea what the job of the plugger was and what they would do to befriend you. I think in my first 2 weeks at Radio 1, because I was still living in Newcastle and coming down to prep for the one show a week, you know, a guy called John Myers, who was a Geordie plugger from EMI, I mean, he tried to invite me for lunch every day. I think I gave in and went 3 or 4 times. And I just thought I could just be the size of a house if I carry on like this. The pluggers were always such great company and always had great stories. Britain's favourite Radio 1. Being in the building allowed me to also close up observe people who I'd grown up listening to, especially the daytime guys like Bates and Steve. I think Bates was a hero because he was... I don't think anybody really knows what music Simon likes. I always say about Simon, I think he did radio using about 25% of his brain. But watching him operate and seeing what that capability was as a broadcaster was quite something.
So very quietly, without a row, he packed his clothes and left, leaving Denise and the girls behind. She didn't know what to do. Family and friends were very supportive.
And Steve, then and now, knew exactly what he was constructing, and very big brain making a format which is absolutely timeless. So getting to close up and watch those people, many of them, not all, and I won't say who wasn't, but they were very welcoming. I think they could see that I was absolutely no threat to them, but I was interested. Don't know if it would be flattering, but I think they gave me time, which I'm grateful. Watching them meant you're seeing how they do it as well as hearing how they do it. And I think I understood much more about how to do national radio than I would have done if I had not seen them. Because it's about what they do with their craft and how they apply themselves to it and the focus. I've done this long enough to know what a lot of people do their broadcasting. I understand exactly what they do. I can't do what they do, but I understand it. And I think you get that sometimes if you're lucky enough to be inside watching the people who are absolutely peerless.
And now, back to the music on Steve Wright in the Afternoons.
We are BBC Radio 1.
At Radio 1, I had a succession for about 2 years, of 13-week contracts. Then they moved me to a year, and then I'd always grown up listening to the chart, and I'd always had a kind of real kind of deep desire to do that, which is a blessing and a curse, because I had the capability, because I'd always grown up listening to the great chart jocks. The blessing is that I got to do it, and I did it for a long time, and most people thought I did it reasonably well.
It's down six places to number 15, Tapao with Valentine. Good afternoon, it's Mark Goodyear for Bruno Brooks with the official UK Top 40, and we reckon still a couple of new entries.
The curse is, I think people who employed me really thought of me as a chart jock, and it also stopped me becoming a broadcaster, because at Radio 1 I was a DJ. I was no more than that, and the people who were very successful at Radio 1 were people who were more than that. I ended up doing the chart a bit and depth the chart for Bruno pretty early on, and then I was asked to do a weekend show with Liz Kershaw. I like Liz. I really didn't like the experience at the time because she was a much better rounded broadcaster than I was, and I was struggling to find my own voice and get into my own kind of headspace on Radio 1. So I was on the desk, and she was really so much more capable as a communicator. I found it awfully difficult to keep up, to be honest with you. And I think Johnny heard that. I think Johnny Beerling, controller, heard that and knew that I couldn't thrive though I could learn, I just wasn't capable of keeping up.
Monday will be at the Abelland Yacht Club, Isle of Wight. Tuesday, Pier Approach, Bournemouth. Wednesday, it's off to the Esplanade. Yes, on the beach at Weymouth.
Liz is Thursday, super bright, Weymouth was then Carlton, then really gobby northern girl with, you know, both she and Andy have such a wide life experience, and I'd lived this, as previously described, very kind of sheltered, some of it by my own making, linear-focused path. And then I ended up, over time, doing Drive Time for a bit and the Evening Session in the early 90s, which Jeff Smith, who'd come from TFM, I think via World Service, and they paired us and said, will you make a magazine for young people, magazine programme? And we took that and made a music show with a really broad, back to my thing of, you know, you can take the best of any genre and play it if you think it's exciting. And Jeff is hugely clever with music selection. I think we also happened to land at the time of being able to book Radiohead and Nirvana and all of the kind of Manchester thing, really early sessions with all those bands. So we stumbled on the air at a really good time. We didn't do a magazine for young people. We just did a record show with some good features and ideas, and over time earned some reasonable credit with the record industry and with the audience.
Anyway, how long does it normally take you to record an alternate tune?
The quickest we've ever done one's been about 4 hours.
Okay, so to ask you to do it between now and 9 o'clock is pushing it or what?
A bit nail biting.
All right, okay, but can we do it? Is it possible?
It is possible, yeah, we'll, you know, fingers crossed.
Now, just to prove this is completely live, dear listener.
3 years on that was really good for me. It enabled me to be what I'd grown up hoping I could be, which was a sort of, you know, like Johnny Walker, you know, a music fan on the radio. And I think without doing that, I think I might have been gone a long time ago, because I think that if I'd have just carried on being a disc jockey, there's a lot of disc jockeys. You can hire them and you can mould them, as stations have done so much in the last decade. If you haven't been able to create or lucky enough to be put in a position where you can do something where people can really hear your passion, I think I could have been gone at that point. In fact, I know for a fact because Trevor Dan told me that he and Matthew used to sit along in Marylebone Road at Radio London saying, well, when we get over to Radio 1, they'll be gone, he'll be gone, he'll be gone, he'll be gone. And I was one of the people who was definitely going to be gone. But I think the Evening Session made a difference.
This is 1053 and 1089 medium wave, the frequencies formerly occupied by BBC Radio 1. Radio 1 is now an FM-only station. Please retune your radio.
It's really tempting when you get into a position where, you know, at Radio 1, you're earning decent money. I'm doing 10 voiceovers a week. You know, I'm never out of Angel Sound, which is a legendary London studio, probably there two or three times a day, some weeks in the across most of the years in the 90s, and you're doing two or three DJ gigs a week at unis or clubs. It's really tempting to be satisfied with that. That we set up Wise Buddha in 94 proves that I wasn't satisfied with that, but I think maybe, had I not done the Evening Session, I could have probably just been that chart jock. And I can see where, during the periods of the 90s where I was the DJ on Radio 1 in either the afternoons or drive time, I could see why people who might become a future controller would say, well, I can find another one of those. I know it's I accept that it's not that easy to do a chart show well, but there is more to radio than being a chart DJ. And that's one of the reasons why much later I went to Smooth to work for John Myers and John Simons, because I wanted to learn to be a broadcaster.
That's the new song from Rumour at Smooth Radio. I tell you, she has the voice on many songs on the new album, which is out on the 1st of November. And that's
Top of the Pops. It was fun to do. The Radio 1 DJs had, I think if you were on mainstream, you probably ended up being on Top of the Pops every 6 weeks or maybe 8 weeks. And I did it from late 80s to mid 90s and sporadically later. And I think I made a mistake with television. There will be people who work in broadcasting who wanted to be famous and on telly. And there's nothing wrong with that if you've got the skill and that's what you want to do. And I would not say that's a bad reason to want to work in broadcasting. Because my whole thing was, I thought finding great records, playing records on the radio, being a radio person was my thing. I found it very uncomfortable. I used to drive to Elstree later and TV Centre in the early times when I was doing it. When it was a live show, and when there were people, there was some great, really amazing old school telly pros who did Top of the Pops. And when they did, and they did two rehearsals and a live show, and they were totally welcoming, I could cope with that. But at other times, when it was, you know, hours of rehearsals and 3 hours of filming for 30 minutes on the air, I used to drive to TV Centre or Elstree thinking, why am I doing this? I'm really not good at it. I just can't, you know, I'm not a TV person. I used to sort of psych myself into a negative state. It was stupid because actually I wasn't that bad at it. I was definitely not, you know, a TV pro. And I judged myself against people who I knew and were friends of mine in the business, like Philip Schofield, who is like the ultimate natural TV broadcaster. And I always used to think, well, I'm rubbish at this. I should never do it. And I only realised that whilst I was never an expert or a pro, that wasn't rubbish, was when years later my then young kids found some VHS tapes and started playing them of me hosting Top of the Pops. And they said to me, you did that show? That's really cool. And actually, I wasn't that bad at it. Can you imagine what it's like to be doing something, presenting all the time thinking, I'm really bad at this. I made a mistake. I got myself into a really kind of bad place. But in a way, that doesn't trouble me, because I never would have been great at TV, and I think I could still be reasonable at radio.
He always goes down well on the Pops. Jason Donovan, When You Come Back to Me, and now the countdown from 10 to the big number one.
So after failing at Radio Tay Breakfast, I did Breakfast on Radio 1, because after Simon Mayo, and let's not forget how big a show that was. I think Radio 1 had 20 million listeners at the time Simon Mayo was doing Breakfast, of the order of. Simon Mayo was absolutely the right guy at the right time to do that show, produced by Rick Blaxall, who was extremely good producer for that sequence. And Steve didn't want to take over straight away, and he wanted to start doing it in the January. And I'm not sure if Matthew asked me to do it, knowing that what he had discussed over in Marylebone Road previously might come to fruition, and thought, well, it doesn't really matter much what happens here. I don't know that that's the case, actually, because I think I'd sort of, with the evening session, made myself a bit more useful. But Matthew said, will you do 4 months? I said yes, because I think I've learned to say no a bit more now. I said yes, because I always wanted to be the guy who would be a help, not hindrance. I kind of always, throughout my whole radio presenting career up to when I left Radio 1, I always thought if I can be one of the guys who they can rely on, that will give me a better chance of keeping a good gig, which I loved. I really loved. I always knew that there were other people whose nuisance value would be greater than their usefulness, and I didn't want to be one of those. I think I got that one slightly wrong. I probably should have said no a little more often, but I never felt confident and comfortable to do that. So I did it, and actually I loved doing it. And, you know, who else would be playing Ice Cube and Cypress Hill? And nobody would be playing in that era apart from me and Rick being, and Jeff Smith being playlist guru at Radio 1. Nobody else had been brave enough to do what actually later became such a smart form of music to be able to showcase across all genres. And I don't think I was great at it, but I think I did a decent caretaker job. I'm in the list of people who presented the Radio 1 breakfast show, but not really. You know, I was the stand-in guy. When the BBC had their Pick of the Pops kink in the road this year and I was asked to do it, I did it because it needed to be done. They didn't want to kill the format or lose the format. And I thought, if I do this, you know, and I did a reasonable job of it because it's a chart show. But Johnny Walker always said to me, remember, Mark, the Depp guy never gets the show. And I actually didn't do it because I thought I wanted the show. But the standing guy doesn't get the gig, and the standing guy didn't get the Radio 1 breakfast show, and quite rightly didn't get Pick of the Pops. And I'm okay with that, you know. You can play a little contribution sometimes, and it didn't do me any harm at Radio 1.
Goodyear Breakfast next week has some spectacular prizes. 26 tokens and a huge sack of swag on the identikit. You can win a young person.
Johnny Walker was one of the first radio indies. Wizard Productions did the stereo sequence on Radio 1. And then towards the end of Johnny Beerling's time and then into Matthew and later Andy Parfitt's time, they put programmes out to tender. I think they did that as a way of looking for ideas. And actually, that has been very successful for the BBC. And I'll credit Bauer latterly because they've also embraced having ideas from outside of their own zone, really. I think the BBC has benefited hugely across all of the stations from just having other people who have got ambition and creative ideas, because when those two things collide and a scheduled slot is available, some good stuff can happen. And we bid for the Thursday night, I think it was. Collins and McConey's Hit Parade was our piss take of a round table, and we got really super bright journalists, all of whom have gotten on to have amazing careers. David Quantick, Miranda Sawyer, Andrew Collins, Stuart McConey presented. Marianne Hobbs was a regular. Steve Lamacq was a regular. That was one show a week on a decent budget, which enabled me to hire one person and then two people to start building a business. And I said earlier on, you know, sometimes I just get an idea and I think it's a good idea, so I'm just going to do it and nobody can talk me out of it. I thought, this is an opportunity. I've done this long enough. I know what to do here. Everybody who was on it was a brilliant writer. I think we made a very funny show, so we built the business and then we just pitched or sold. I mean, sometimes, you know, you can have an idea and there's not a slot that they're tendering. You can just have an idea and you can go and talk to somebody. And this is the case. I know it's the case at Bauer, but sometimes still is the case at the BBC. You could take them something and they think, I have to have that. So you get to make it. And we became very successful. Andy Parfitt did an amazing job of taking Radio 1 from what it was before Matthew and then Matthew's attempt at making it youth. I honestly don't think that change in 94, I don't think, with the greatest credit to Matthew for being super brave and making a change, I don't think that he and the team around him understood what youth was. I think there was a need for a move, but they didn't quite know how to go from DLT to Steve Lamacq. But Andy Parfitt knew, and he knew that in the 90s he needed dance culture and they needed, you know, to talk to the young non-white audience. So we provided a lot of solutions by being able to bring to radio people who were not broadcasters, natural broadcasters, who were DJs, but we also brought people who were broadcasters like Trevor Nelson into Radio 1. That era was extremely important for Radio 1, and we were one of only a couple of companies who were there who Andy trusted to do it. And we did that. We built our business on that. I mean, from 94 to 2002, with a couple of kinks in the road, we were very lucky, and we had a great team of producers. That period is a golden period for me because I was still on the air doing six shows a week, still doing the gigs, still doing the voiceovers, but we also had people in Wise Buddha who I absolutely could trust to have the same conviction and passion and belief as I did in. We were doing it for the radio station, but we were really doing it for the listeners. The people who work here at Wise Buddha work for Wise Buddha, but actually the minute they get into making some output or creating some output or transmitting something, they work for the radio station and the listeners. We never think that we're some kind of guerrilla contingent inside a broadcasting organisation. What you have to do, what I have to do, I think this is true of a lot of people in our business. There are many people who get into broadcasting or stuff that Wise Buddha does, which is connected to broadcasting, like our studio business or our Voices and Artist Agency or our jingle company, you get into that because you've been a practitioner. And that doesn't always qualify you to run a business. And the mistakes that I've made because I'm not a professional businessman. There are people who run companies who are trained to be CEOs, and the really good ones understand creative, but actually really know how to run a business. And I've never been one of those. So when we have problems, some of them are down to the fact that I am that person who can only go in one direction. And, you know, I've learned over the years I need to listen more. But one of the things I've been quite good at, though not imperfect, is finding people who share an ambition to do really good stuff, to have fun with it, and to have great vibe and great energy. My personal best place is dealing with creative people and helping to create environments where they can thrive. And I think the best example of that, honestly, is, it's tough to single out one, but the most successful, I should say, example of that is the Jingle Company. We just have maybe 12 people across all of our music output in our production library, our jingle and our company and our production service imager. Phenomenal, talented people who share our vision, and we're on all over the world, so that's a good place to be. I think that the Jingle Company, or I suppose the Jingles and Imager, we cover a lot of ground. So I really like what we've done for BBC Radio 2. I think that when we took over, that was the kind of end of the older, more middle-of-the-road era of Radio 2. In fact, they'd gone past the end on the air, but they were still running station imaging, which was kind of behind where their output is. We've made two packages for Radio 2, which have been on the leading edge of where their output is. And, you know, most people we deal with want to run their imaging slightly hotter than their output, because that helps with the forward momentum and the sense of energy. I'm very pleased at what we did for Bauer, City One, all of the big legacy stations, many of which I've worked for over the years.
K103.
How can you not love Manchester?
I love the people, the vibe of the city.
We are made in Manchester.
It's the place to be.
We're very successful in other places. We're on three or four of the top seven stations in Holland. And so the stuff we've done for 538 and Sky Radio, I think, is some of the best stuff in the world of station jingles or imaging. Seeing the difference between the UK now and other markets, with the exception, I think, of some of our clients. You know, we did Magic and Absolute, as well as Radio 2 and Bauer City 1. I think those clients and those stations really understand that station identity that makes the station recognisable, you should not be embarrassed about, you should be proud of. And I think all of those worked really well. I think in the UK, many other people who run radio stations, imaging is a kind of not a first order or second or third order of things. I think sometimes it's like a 10th order of things. That's really different in some of the European markets, where they make a new package every year. Not our client, but Energy in France, which is one of the most amazingly programmed stations, they'll do a new package every year. Not all of our clients in Holland will, but we know that the jingles and the imaging are so important to them. And I, you know, that makes sense to me, because if your radio station sound and brand is strong, and your air talent is strong, and your playlisting is strong, then you've got a much better chance than if you're just relying on the air talent or your record set to deliver you the output. I wish everybody would think that way. Then we could do more jingles from Even to this day, I'm still the shy kid from Edinburgh. I've learnt to not be, and anybody who works with me will laugh when they hear me say that, but I do not push myself in to conversations. So, for example, if anybody who I respect or who is very successful is in a conversation, I'll never butt into a conversation. And I remember early on, I think must have been when we started doing stuff at Radio 2, and we were, and I maybe was depping occasionally. I used to get invited to Jim Moyer's Christmas parties, which were legendary. And he was, you know, Jim Moyer was an impresario. And Jim Moyer, controller who, you know, was a very big supporter of, with Leslie Douglas, who was his deputy and then the controller, was a very big supporter of Wise Buddha, used to throw these parties to which he'd invite everybody. I mean, I maybe only did a few depths, or we made a couple of programs and we'd be invited to the Christmas party. And at those, there would be people who I knew, and there'd be people who, like Terry, who I at first didn't. And my recollection of him was that he was always so absolutely gracious, knew who you were. And from me, I would never assume that he would know who I was. And he was always utterly charming, welcoming, and kind of wise, you know. I remember years before we got to make a programme with him, Alan Boyd, who was his then producer on The Breakfast Show, said, come and have a lunch with me and Terry. And we went to a restaurant in Marylebone, not far from the BBC. And I know, I'd been running Wise Buddha maybe for 15 years, and we found ourselves talking about, you know, what if of he would ever be produced externally. I mean, that was me pushing, but he was extremely gracious, whilst at no point saying, yes, I want to do this. And he had this real knack of engaging with people and making them feel like the conversation was worthwhile. You know, that thing I said earlier on about watching people, a lot of people in radio talk a lot but don't always listen. And I did that for so many years of my life. If there's one thing I learned from Terry, was that he listened a lot and then he spoke. He never pushed himself forward, except, you know, if he's on the telly, he's going to be the star. But I think that thing about not having to get what you've got to say out is such a powerful thing. I don't know why it took me my whole life and what within the last few years to realise that. When you wait for people to, other people to talk, you have time to form your thoughts. Then your thoughts are better thoughts most of the time. That was him off the air, and I think that was him on the air when we got to see him as we produced him. A lot of time was spent forming his thoughts, not just shooting from the hip. And I think that's incredibly powerful for people in radio.
This is Radio 1. Now here's Richard Evans with a special news bulletin.
Diana, Princess of Wales, and Dodie Fayed have been killed in a car crash.
I had two experiences of being on the air on really difficult days. The first one was when Princess Diana died. My slot was 10 till 1. I think I came in earlier, and we played appropriate music and made the announcements. That was a very, very strange day. The chart was on the Sunday afternoon, and I said to Jeff Smith, there's no way we can do a chart today. That's absolutely crazy. Both Jeff and I really thought that there would be a chance that either we would do a chart or Richard at Capital and the network at that point would do the chart. And we persuaded Matthew and Richard to have a conversation. I think we asked Matthew, we said, we shouldn't be doing that. And I think they had a conversation. To the best of my recollection, that they did have a conversation and they decided it would be nuts to do that. And I think we got that one right. But that was a very, very odd day to be on the air, because you were doing something you just not expected. You literally had to do your best without having really any. And there's no contingency for that. There is an OBIT. OBIT is a different thing. It's a procedural thing. It's not teaching you how to broadcast what to say in that eventuality.
Goodbye, England's rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the greatest place to sell.
And I'm not saying these are exactly the same, but I'm really saying they're not that very different. When Terry was ill, I did know he was ill because he hadn't been on air, and we were producing that slot with him and then with Richard and now with Michael Ball. I felt that news was going to come, but I didn't know it was going to come that weekend, and certainly not on that day. And I didn't know that I'd be asked to participate. But Bob had spoken to Steve, and I think Steve was really quite upset, and I don't think Steve felt he could do the 9 o'clock show, you know, within a couple of hours of hearing that news. And Bob said to me, will you do it? And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I kind of instinctively knew what we had to do. And one thing was I phoned Alan Boyd, who's my lifelong friend from Clyde, who'd produced Terry, and I said, you have to come in and do this with me. Because Alan knew every song that Terry knew and loved. I knew I had to let the audience write the script, because Terry let the audience write the script. But it was not an easy opening link to come on the air at 9 o'clock, just after the announcement, halfway through the bulletin, and break that news. I mean, and to continue to break it as people tuned in.
Bob Shannon, the controller of Radio 2, said Terry established himself as one of the greatest and most popular radio hosts this country has ever heard. BBC News, it's 5 minutes past nine.
Hello, this is Mark Goodyear with you today on Radio 2 as we remember Sir Terry Wogan, who passed away early this morning. He was one of the foundations on which Radio 2 was built. And so
even thinking about it now, I feel quite emotional because I think it was, I remember it on the day being quite difficult at times to hold it together because it was a big thing. And the audience would tell stories, though. It was a very undulating story arc from the listeners. Some people were extremely sad, and some people made it funny. And so, because the audience wrote the script, it made the show, with the music we know he loved, it was a difficult but a really pleasurable thing to do, and a job that you kind of, you're not trained for it, really. Well, you kind of are trained for it as a broadcaster, but you just don't know, except instinctively, how to do it. And I think that, you know, the audience responded very positively. I think they thought we did the right thing.
I could be a millionaire if I had the money.
I have been asked quite a lot since Pick of the Pops to deputise it too. That's great fun. I have gone past the, at least for now, the ambition of wanting to do a show every day. I did 6 years at Smooth and I loved that. I still like to do one show a week on the radio, but I haven't had that offer from anywhere. I have another job, you know. We have these 3/4 businesses we're trying to run here. So that's why I can't do every day. And, you know, I sometimes think back to my manager, co-manager, when I first came to Radio 1, Peter Powell, who, when he stopped on the air, he stopped on the air. I sometimes think that was incredibly smart because there was no ambiguity about what he stood for. He stood for his business, James Grant, which has gone on to become arguably the most successful TV agency in this country. I think being on the air is, for somebody like me, because of why I did it in the first place, and because, as I described earlier, I love the business and I really love it as a place for encouraging and making opportunity for creative people. For some reason, I cannot not be on the air forever. Jacqueline, my wife, will say to me, that's your ego talking. It really honestly isn't, because that's never really why I did it. And it sounds ludicrous, doesn't it, to say that, you know, you must be egotistical to be in radio. It really wasn't that. It was really honestly about finding music. I'm not saying that I haven't behaved like an egotistical dick at times. Probably I have. Who in broadcasting hasn't? But I think there's something about when you get it right, which none of us do all the time, presenting the right records in the right way, with passion. I think it's attractive to listen to, and it's really attractive to do. I think if I can find a show a week somewhere, I'd probably do it. I interviewed Duke Fakir from the Four Tops the other day, and I said to him, you're 80, your birthday is on Boxing Day, you've been doing this job for, you know, 63 years. He said, except I haven't been doing a job. I love this, and, you know, singing is what I always wanted to do. That resonates with me. And actually, I'm not sure I even need to be remembered for anything. I kind of think that the story of what I've managed to do with broadcasting and with Wise Buddha is actually, for me, it's been a great life. And although sometimes it's been really hard work, sometimes I've had difficulties that are of my making that I've managed to navigate, but that's part of life. And when you do this as a career, I don't think you really want to not do it, either broadcasting or running a production indie. Would I like to have a bit more time on my hands at some point? Yeah, but when I hear people like Johnny Walker, and when I heard Terry at 77, and you hear some of the broadcasters who really know how to communicate, I quite like to have another 20 years, if that's okay.